Welcome to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, covering topics of interest to lawyers handling civil appellate matters in Texas courts. This podcast demystifies appellate law and pulls back the curtain on the Texas appellate system through conversations with judges, court staff, and top trial and appellate practitioners. Listen in to discover best practices and tips for successfully presenting your case, managing your docket, and promoting efficiency through legal technology. And now here are your hosts, Todd Smith and Jody Sanders.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. I'm Todd Smith.
And I'm Jody Sanders.
We have with us today Dan Huckabee from Court Surety Bond Agency. Dan, welcome to the show.
It's great to be with you guys.
Well, we talked about supersedious issues a few times on the show, and we just happened to have a good contact over there at CSBA because, just for full disclosure purposes, we need to let everybody know that your company is one of our two original sponsors of the Texas Appellate Law Podcast.
Yep, glad to be a founding sponsor.
Well, we are too. We're really grateful for you helping us out to make this thing.
Absolutely. So, Dan, why don't you tell the listeners a little bit about yourself and about CSBA, just from a broad perspective, what it is that you all do?
Sure. So, Court Surety Bond Agency started in 1984, and we specialize in surety bonds. And interesting, probably, fact to the listeners is surety bonds is a part of the insurance industry, and it represents a very, very small fraction, which is about 1%. And we further have kind of a narrower focus than just surety bonds, which is specializing in supersedes bonds, which that's an even tinier sliver with representing about 2% of the surety industry. So that's kind of our whole business. We work with attorneys throughout the country in all state and federal courts.
So you mentioned surety bonds being the broader industry. So are you all doing like construction bonds, for example, as well?
We do, yes.
Okay. That's good to know. There are occasionally, our focus today is really on supersedious, but you know, there are occasions where appellate lawyers and Texas trial lawyers need to get other kinds of bonds, like a temporary injunction bond, for example. And so I will file that away for future reference for the next time I need a TI bond. So you all work, you're basically a bond broker. Is that right?
That's right. So we represent 35 different, we refer to them as surety companies. They're essentially insurance companies in the industry that provide these types of bonds. And those companies range from, you know, household names like Liberty Mutual, Zurich, you know, to more independent companies that may be smaller or privately owned that may just focus on that one product.
Let's think about the average situation, if there is such a thing, in which your company gets called, just to kind of overview what supersedious is for those listening to the show who don't have a deep familiarity with it. Generally, in Texas, we use that term to describe essentially securing a judgment against execution. Once there's been a final judgment ordinarily rendered in a case in which, you know, the liability has been finally determined and there's a judgment creditor and a judgment debtor. And the function, jump in here anytime, but, and Dan, you too, because I know you know a lot about this. The function essentially of a supersedious bond is to preserve the status quo. One of the parties is pursuing an appeal.
I think that's right. And also to protect the judgment creditor from the risk that the judgment debtor may go insolvent or, you know, suffer some sort of financial setback or move assets around or whatever during the course of the appeal in the event that they're not able to execute because it stayed. And, you know, there's four main ways you can do it in Texas under the TRAP rules and the CPRC. And one, of course, is a written agreement between the parties, which is great if you can get it, but I'll tell you, I don't know that I've ever actually had that in a case where there was a damage judgment. And then, of course, there's supersedious bonds, which we're going to dive into here in more detail here in a minute. There's a cash deposit in lieu of bond, which again is great if you have a client that can just cut a check and part with it for 2 years for whatever the bond amount is. And then the fourth one is alternative security, which is a little bit kind of murky and nebulous, and no courts have really told us what that is. But my best guess is, if you're somebody that has a lot of unencumbered assets and you don't want to go through the collateralization process and you can get a court to approve it, you could post that as security. But again, I'll tell you, in practice, I have not actually seen that accomplished yet. So I guess there's a possibility for that out there. So I think supersedious tends to be the most common, maybe with cash deposit behind it, depending on the circumstances of the judgment.
So tell us from your perspective, Dan, what do you ordinarily see when you have, say, a judgment debtor coming to you? What's the process like for them if they're going to come to Court Surety Bond Agency and say, all right, I've decided, you know, I'm not going to put up a cash deposit or use one of the other methods available under Texas law. We're going to post a bond. What's the next step?
I think the first things we encourage attorneys to advise their clients on is to explore the options as early as possible. And oftentimes that might even mean before a judgment is entered, because that additional time that they get prove pretty valuable depending on what their circumstances are. But after they've made that step and have decided to explore, then when someone calls us, really our first part of the process is to find out what's the anticipated judgment amount, what's the time frame we're looking at, you know, when does the judgment get entered, is there any post-trial issues that are going to come up that could delay, give added time. And once we kind of know those two things, then we talk about the profile of the client, and who that client is going to determine whether collateral is required or not to obtain the bond. There's companies like publicly traded companies, insurers, or large private companies, or even high net worth individuals that can sometimes qualify for the bonds without providing any collateral. And so that kind of becomes one route. And if we determine that may be the case, then we'll often get the necessary financial statements from them to determine that and explore that avenue. And then in the other cases where collateral is required, then it's really going through each of the options for collateral, which there are four types of collateral that can be used to secure a supersedes bond: cash, letters of credit from a bank, real estate, or stock and bond portfolios and non-retirement accounts.
Spend less time analyzing data and more time digging into the facts with litigation analytics on Westlaw Edge. Powered by the largest collection of federal and state dockets, litigation analytics instantly aggregates data points to produce information such as likely timeline, outcomes, representation, and damages, from which you can base your case strategy and assess potential litigation costs and resources and position yourself for success. Gain a strategic edge using data-driven insights with litigation analytics on Westlaw Edge.
And so we're talking about, you know, cash deposit being an option within the Texas rules, but then you're talking about it as a separate idea in terms of cash collateral to provide to the surety.
Right.
Would there be an advantage to posting cash through a surety as opposed to posting a cash deposit, putting the money in the court's registry?
It's probably the most common question we get, and there can be. So what we typically find is cases that are under $200,000 or $300,000, oftentimes it makes more sense to post the cash directly with the court. When there's cases that are larger than that, there can be different circumstances that come into play. One of those circumstances, and it's an interesting environment right now, but surety companies pay interest on cash deposits. So there are times when the interest rate environment is higher than it is now, where the interest rates paid by the surety is actually enough or maybe exceeds the premium that the client is paying for the bond. So it makes sense for them financially, even though they're paying a premium, they're getting enough, you know, return on the cash that they're just as good or better off going through the bond process. And sometimes, even if it's like an equal to situation, sometimes people prefer going the bond route just because the mechanics of filing a bond sometimes are a little bit more well known, or sometimes it's people have concern over putting significant sums of cash with the court. That's kind of a more of a personal preference. So we've kind of encountered all those situations. I would say probably one of the other most significant factors would be when cash is used as, I call it a bridge or like a temporary situation to buy time to stay enforcement of the judgment and then ultimately substitute it later on for another form of collateral that might take longer. And we see that with, we've done that with letters of credit or real estate, or even one time we had a company that had a parent that was based in Europe, and we couldn't get the financial statements in time from the parent that was going to indemnify. So we got cash, provided the bond, and then later on got the financial statement, confirmed that their indemnity was sufficient to provide the bond without any collateral, and the surety company returned the collateral.
Well, I know in Texas, you know, you can put up a cash deposit, but you have to go and ask the court, at least here in Travis County, to actually put it in an interest-bearing account. And the interest, as you suggest, is not something that you're going to retire on, even if it's a large judgment. But it sounds like if the economy's maybe a little healthier and you're able to make some money on the interest, that going through a surety, you might be able to actually really offset your cost, even if you're posting a cash deposit to, or a cash bond, I guess you would call it, in that situation.
Yeah, and there's, again, depending on the, you know, the interest rate environment, but there are some interesting and creative tools. You know, one is just sometimes the sureties have their own program where they'll pay, you know, a simple interest. And then other sureties that we have will programs where they able to put it in an account with, say, a Raymond James or Wells Fargo, and they can actually invest in certain things like treasuries or municipal bonds. So again, you know, they're able to kind of compare what the returns on those investments might be. They're generally going to be, you know, very stable and safe options, that the surety is not going to allow investments in options that may fluctuate too greatly, but it's, you know, presents other options for the clients to consider.
So you mentioned cash, a letter of credit, real estate, I believe, and securities is the four types of collateral that you all generally look at.
Right.
Was there anything more to cash? I think we ought to touch on each one of those briefly, just for our listeners' benefit. Was there anything more about cash, or are you ready to move on to letter of credit?
No, I think that's probably sufficient for cash.
Okay.
So with letters of credit, for those people that might be listening and aren't familiar, letters of credit are provided by banks, and they're essentially a financial instrument. They're literally a letter where the bank is making available a certain amount of funds and to the surety company. So there's no funds are actually handed over to the surety company in that case, but the surety company could demand, make a demand against that letter of credit at any point in time if there was a claim against their bond. So the sureties like these because they are somewhat safer than cash in a way, just which might be counterintuitive. But the big risk with cash is the bankruptcy preference laws. So sureties can be at risk to lose those assets if someone files bankruptcy. So with the letter of credit, they have the same liquid nature as cash, but the surety doesn't run into those bankruptcy preference issues. The real risk for the surety in these cases is whether the bank is solvent at the time that, you know, a demand is made. And, you know, a lot of times that for most people, that probably sounds like a remote risk, and it can be. But, you know, if you think back to the 2008 Great Recession, there were, you know, it certainly has happened in the course of our history where there's been times where banks have gone out of business and sureties have been left holding letters of credit that they couldn't draw on. So because of that, the sureties do have to approve the bank that's being used. And then really the only other step to it is the sureties all have their own formats for the letter of credit that we end up providing to the client, their bank. And they usually are much of an issue in terms of the agreement between the two parties.
In terms of timing, it seems like a letter of credit may be advantageous for the client who's coming to you, because if, say, they've got a pre-existing relationship with their bank and the bank maybe has appraisals on the real estate or already holds some of their securities and their cash, you're just taking a step out of the process, you know, in the underwriting process, I would think, because they just come with the letter of credit, which automatically goes through the surety process without you having to do the back end work of appraising real estate, getting financial statements, getting all that stuff that would normally build in time to the process.
Yeah, no, you make a great point, because a lot of times, especially for companies with existing banking relationships, they have ongoing banking relationships where their banks are familiar with their assets, their operations, and they already may have credit facilities in place. And so because of that, like you mentioned, a lot of the underwriting has already kind of been done from that standpoint. So it doesn't mean there's things that, you know, won't need to be done in order to actually get the letter of credit from the banks, but, you know, it can be a quicker process to go that route rather than starting from scratch for the surety company. And that also highlights kind of another point that we mentioned to people, is that if you don't have an existing banking relationship letters of credit might be a little bit more difficult and time consuming. It's like applying for a loan. So something to consider. And it doesn't mean it's not, can't be a good option for a company or individual that doesn't have, you know, those type of relationships or credit facilities established, but it's just something to factor into the equation. We do find letters of credit, especially on the individual side, can be good for people who might have accounts, like brokerage accounts with, say, a company like Merrill Lynch that's tied to Bank of America or Wells Fargo, and they have a brokerage account there. Because they're attached from a banking standpoint, sometimes what those banks can do is they can use the brokerage account with the stocks and bonds in it to secure the letter of credit without having to liquidate any of those assets. And so that becomes kind of a quicker and easier way for the client to get the letter of credit, even if they don't have necessarily that kind of, you know, facility in place.
And do banks generally charge either a fee or kind of a premium of their own to do the letter of credit and leave that in place?
They do, yes. So there is that added cost to it. And it's similar to a bond premium in the sense that it'll be an annual fee during the course of that the letter of credit is outstanding.
That's always something good to keep in mind as you're kind of thinking through the costs.
Right.
And a letter of credit, if you got into a situation where you could get a letter of credit pretty quickly, but I think you mentioned that might be a possible sort of a gap bridging tool to use. If you needed something in place relatively fast, you already had that banking relationship, and then you could get a letter of credit ready to go so that when the judgment becomes enforceable, you could get it on file and if necessary, approved, whichever court you're in. And then, you know, long-term for an appeal that's going to last years, I guess it would just depend on the case, wouldn't it? Whether someone would want to rely on the letter of credit and renew it as opposed to renewing, say, a supersedious bond that's secured by some other asset.
Yeah, I would say that's a big part of what we end up working through with clients is understanding, first of all, what assets they have available, but then kind of what their preferences are, because everybody's different. And, you know, you will have one client that may want to use a letter of credit and another that would not be an ideal situation for. And so even though they might have access to it, because maybe they have, you know, a borrowing capacity and they don't want to impede that borrowing capacity. So really kind of stepping in each of those different categories and then also layering that in with the time frame that they have to actually post this bond, because while they may have a preference, they have to prioritize making sure that their assets don't get pursued and under the judgment. So there's kind of a combination of factors that have to be considered.
Well, in Texas, we have the benefit of basically a 30-day window after the judgment is signed,
right,
where it can become enforceable, and that can be extended out with the post-judgment motion pretty easily. You know, the times I've done this in federal court, it really is, you know, you better get everything in line because that judgment is going to become enforceable and I forget what it is, 10 days or something like that, really short time frame.
Yeah, it was 14 and they've moved it to 30 now, which is helpful.
I haven't bonded a federal judgment in a couple of years.
It was a big deal when they changed it to 30 days because it's like you said, with only 14 days, that's really hard to do a lot of this stuff.
Well, and in Texas, you have the benefits of the caps. And so you can sometimes buy a little bit of time with trying to figure out how the caps play. And then in federal court, you bond the judgment and there's not right. A whole lot you can do about it.
Yeah, our supersedious rules, you know, that changed, gosh, and you would even say many years ago now, back in 2003, you know, in the old days, you were talking about having to bond the amount of the judgment. And now in Texas, it's bonding the actual compensatory damages in the judgment, interest for the duration of appeal. And what's the third one, Jody?
Costs.
Costs. Yeah, costs never seem to be a big factor. That's why I keep forgetting it.
No, that's not where the fights are.
No.
And then you have the net worth alternative, half your net worth or $25 million maximum caps. And so there's a lot of fights over net worth too.
Oh yeah, we do a lot of litigation, Dan, in Texas over the amount of the bond. I'm sure it happens in other places. I've had it happen in federal court. But the fight is not over. It's not set in stone just because the judgment's been signed, you know, what the amount of the bond is going to be. You also mentioned real estate. How does that work in using real estate as collateral?
Real estate's probably one of those lesser known options, but as you can imagine, it's probably, you know, one of the more important options that is available. And essentially, you can kind of think of it as really the same process that a lender goes through when they, you know, evaluate a piece of property, what its value is, how much equity is in the property. And then ultimately what the surety company does is they place a deed of trust on the property to secure their position. So the first step that a surety will do is we will get, you know, the address and details on a particular property and provide that to them to see if it's kind of worth taking to the next step, which would be appraisal. An appraisal is pretty much required on every instance. There can be some exceptions, you know, if a recent appraisal has been done or the value is so overwhelming relative to the bond amount. But in general, you know, the appraisal process is kind of the next step. And then once that comes back, if it confirms the value and the amount of equity that's in the property, then the surety goes through that process of placing the deed of trust on it, like I mentioned, and then the bond is issued based on that. There's a pretty wide variety of real estate that can be considered too, residential, commercial, multifamily. We've done retail centers, a lot of different types of property that generally will stay away from those kind of specialized properties, things like a hospital that's highly regulated, or we had a winery once that, you know, it's so unique that, you know, the number of buyers for a winery, they want things that they're not in the real estate business.
Right.
The number of transactions they do relative to, say, like a large mortgage company is going to be, you know, just a tiny fraction. So they're really looking for easily assess, you know, the value. They know in a worst case scenario, if they had to sell it, they can have a market, you know, to be able to sell that property. So that tends then to kind of narrow it down to those types of properties I just mentioned. And also the location being, you know, paramount as well. You know, properties that are maybe a custom build, an area that not very densely populated and doesn't have a lot of comparable sales, those are going to be more difficult. A lot of times we come across ranches in Texas, and those can be very challenging. They certainly have a lot of worth, but, you know, for a surety company to evaluate, it's not very practical. So more the suburban, you know, homes and or those other, you know, commercial type properties that I mentioned in densely populated areas are going to be the more likely candidates.
Providing surety bonds for court-related matters is a very niche industry, and there are very few appeal bond specialists who are as experienced as Court Surety Bond Agency. Whether the client is a sophisticated entity or an individual involved in litigation for the first time, CSBA uses its more than 110 years of combined surety experience handling appeal bonds to provide first-class service to its clients. For more information, visit courtsurety.com.
And real estate seems like the place where timing and getting your ducks in a row really becomes especially important, because the appraisal process, I would think, takes one of the longer leads in terms of time than any of these other assets. And you especially want to get it done before then the judgment creditors have attached their judgment liens, because then that just makes it even more messy.
Right. Yeah, that's exactly right. The appraisal process and everything does make it the longest, and it can vary. Generally, residential is going to be faster than commercial, just because the appraisals take longer on commercial. And you often find unexpected things when you pull title reports, you know, liens that people didn't know about that have to be cleared, and, you know, just a little nuances that generally don't stop the process, but just make it take a little longer. So anytime anybody indicates real estate is an option they want to consider, that's an area we oftentimes push for, you know, getting started as early as possible. Because a lot of times with real estate, what people don't realize is a bulk of the process comes in with, first of all, identifying the property, getting kind of a preliminary indication from the surety company, pulling title, which pulling title is a few day process and it costs $100. So it's not, you know, these aren't big expenses. And then getting quotes on the appraisal. I mean, all that can take, you know, a week or two just to do that. And really the cost is pretty nominal in the grand scheme of it. So we encourage people to kind of start on that. And we're always more than happy to do that footwork, just because we understand the realities of these cases, that staying enforcement is critical. So then, you know, when it comes to pulling the trigger on an appraisal, it's a matter of personal judgment. I can tell you, if it's, you know, when you're facing multi-million dollar judgments, you know, paying you know, $500 or $1,000 for an appraisal. From my standpoint as a client, I'm sure they get exhausted, you know, going through these things, but it really are small dollar amounts to inch the process closer. Because once you have the appraisal done and everything is signed off, then from there, it's actually pretty quick to get the bond in place. So everybody's got to make their own determination as to how far they want to take that process. But we encourage people to, you know, take it as far as they can or are comfortable with, just because we'll put them in the best position to pull the trigger on the bond quickly.
Is there sort of a formula that bond companies use for how much real estate you need for a particular bond? I mean, for example, I would think they'd want for a $100,000 judgment more than $100,000 worth of real estate. Is there some formula that you typically want to keep in mind when you're trying to figure out what properties you can put together?
Yeah, that is something that's important to think about, because you're exactly right. I always use the analogy that residential lenders, when we go get a home loan, generally don't want to loan, you know, up to 100% of the value of the property, and surety companies are the same way, just because part of what they're looking at is that there could be fluctuations in the value of a property over, you know, the course of a 2-year period while that appeal is pending. So the general rule of thumb, I would say, is residential properties are discounted the value by about 20% on average, maybe a little bit more, just depending on the circumstances. And commercial properties can be discounted anywhere from 30 to 50%. Really depends on the circumstances with that particular property. And that really falls in line. If you look at lenders, most lenders on commercial property will only loan up to 60% of the value on commercial, maybe 70% in some rare cases. So they kind of follow the same patterns as banks do in that regard, in terms of how they discount the value of the properties. And then of course, you know, whatever debt is against the properties, they subtract as well. And that's how you ultimately come up with the equity. So to your point, you might have a property that's worth $500,000, but by the time it's discounted and mortgage is subtracted, there might only be, you know, $100,000 or $200,000 worth of actual equity in the property. So that's one of the things that, again, we can generally do upfront without, you know, incurring any costs, is just getting addresses for properties, you know, understanding a little bit about what they are, seeing if we think it's in the realm of possibility for it to be used. And, you know, if there's multiple properties, which ones might need to be included. And then that at least, you know, kind of starts to pave that way for what's possible and what timeframes the client might be looking at.
Yeah, it's bad enough if you're looking at a large money judgment, but then, you know, you're looking then, and by the time you apply the discounting, you know, the collateral that you might actually have to make available to secure the bond could be considerably more than the actual amount of the judgment, potentially.
Yeah, that's right. So one thing I didn't mention earlier, and it's probably important to mention now, is the collateral can be used in combination with one another. So it's probably another reason bringing back cash into the equation. You know, sometimes we'll have property that maybe have a little bit of debt on it, and it's kind of borderline whether it's acceptable to the surety company, and the client can perhaps add some cash to that collateral that they're offering, and that makes up the difference. So those are avenues we will look as well to kind of see how those things can be pieced together.
Well, how does securities fit into this? We've covered cash, letter of credit, real estate, and now I think securities was the last type that we hadn't talked about yet. We have the other security as ordered by the court, as we pointed out earlier, is another way of securing a judgment in Texas. And I think sometimes what people will do is what we think of as securities. They'll offer those basically to be deposited into the court's registry. But you're talking about taking on, you know, commercial paper and things like that, I assume.
Yes. Yeah. So if people have an account, I had referenced earlier, you know, with Merrill Lynch and a non-retirement account, they have, you know, stocks, an index fund, and some bonds, you know, municipal bonds or treasuries or things like that, then what the surety company can do potentially is work out an agreement with that brokerage company to have, we call it a account control agreement, where they are essentially pledging that account as security for the bond. What that allows them to do is keep those assets in that actual account. A lot of times the surety will allow them to continue managing the account, trading, you know, in the account, so that they can continue to earn their investment returns. And then, you know, one of the other advantages is it doesn't force them to liquidate the account and incur any tax liability or, you know, forego the investment returns that they would have earned.
What about non-public securities? You know, a lot of people that have their money in, say, maybe a smaller family business or partnership, those types of things. Are those things that could be feasible, or there just really isn't a market and it makes it hard to use?
Because there's not a market, they're really not feasible to use. And in those instances, that's where it kind of goes back to probably that letter of credit option, where the, you know, the bank is in a better position to kind of evaluate the credit worthiness of, you know, say a company, you know, a small business, because they have other loans to that business. And so they know their financial wherewithal and their assets and have known the people, you know, for years. You know, that's something that can be kind of overlooked with some of these surety companies. This is a, it can be very kind of a transactional relationship where this might be the only time that surety or that client actually work together. So there's not, unfortunately, a lot you can base on, you know, other things like character that, you know, and some other forms of surety bonds that can be a really important factor. But with these cases, it's really more an analysis of, does the client have the wherewithal and how significant is it relative to the bond that's being requested? And in those cases where the wherewithal is so significant that it's almost a foregone conclusion, you know, the client's going to be able to pay for it themselves, those are basically the instances where the surety will extend, you know, the credit without needing collateral. But in all those other instances, then the option is really to take collateral. And there are times where it can be fall somewhere in between. We have had circumstances where a surety will accept 50 or 75% collateral. I would say those are not all that common. Usually it's kind of an all or nothing scenario, but that is, there are those circumstances where it can happen.
Yeah, I've heard for years that, you know, in your industry that full collateralization is kind of a must. You've lined out a few exceptions to that. That's one of the questions that clients ask is, well, okay, what am I going to have to do to get a bond? And I always advise them, well, you got to be prepared to put up collateral. And I think this discussion has been helpful for them to know, not only the clients, but also other lawyers, trial lawyers in particular, to know the kinds of things that can be pledged as collateral. But, you know, the other major issue or question that comes up is, well, okay, what's my premium going to be? And I know that varies a little, but my recollection of what I understand to be the sort of the industry standard is somewhere between 1% and 2% of the judgment amount. Is that correct?
Yeah, I would say that's a fair estimate or range, although it does vary by the type of collateral, or if collateral is not being required, the financial strength of the company. You know, this recently we've had a couple of publicly traded companies that had very large bonds, and the bond amount can influence the premium rate in circumstances. So these couple of public companies needed very large bonds, and the premium rate was almost 0.25%. So it was very low. I mean, it's based on their financial strength and the fact that it's a larger bond. With cash and letters of credit, 1% to 2% is probably a fair range. Although with cash, it can, or letters of credit, if the bond size is large enough, it can go lower. And then real estate is the most expensive option due to the illiquid nature of the collateral and the cost of putting it in place. So the rate for real estate is 4%. And with marketable securities, it can really range depending on the type of the assets. You know, if it's all treasury bonds, which are fairly liquid and safe, the rate's going to be on the lower end of that 1% to 2% range. But, you know, if it's a S&P 500 index, you know, it can fluctuate significantly and there's more risk that the surety is undertaking, then they're going to charge a higher rate, probably in the 3% range.
And that's a renewable annual premium, if I recall correctly.
That's right. The first year is fully earned, and then any renewals, there is a prorated return premium if the case is concluded midterm.
That's one of those things that's important in Texas, because you don't get your premiums back if you prevail on appeal in Texas, whereas, you know, in federal court you do. So that's always an important cost to think about as the judgment debtor, because that's something you may not see again if you're in Texas state court.
Sure.
And appellees in federal court forget about that. They forget all the time, because particularly if they're used to practicing in state court where bond cost is not a cost or a coverable cost, that can be a pretty big shock if you're not prepared for it. So it's something to alert lawyers to, is, you know, be wary if you're in federal court, because you if you lose and you're the appellee, it can be really bad for you.
We talked a little bit about timing and the importance of timing and kind of making sure that you're thinking through these things early on when it looks like you're going to get an adverse judgment entered against you. And maybe there's not, but is there a typical amount of time that you tell people to kind of plan for the application underwriting process for getting a bond?
Yeah, for each type of, or each situation, I should say, there's kind of a general time frame. With if we're dealing with situations where no collateral is involved and it's a very strong financial situation, then I would say typically a week is more than enough time. Might even just be, we've turned bonds around in just a day or two, if depending on how quick people can get us back information. With the collateral, with cash, it's going to be the quickest out of all the four options, just because it can be wire transferred. Then all it requires is signing documentation and issuing the bond. So that can be done. I would say, again, a week is probably, you know, feasible in that instance too, even shorter potentially. Letters of credit really depends on the relationship with the bank. I would, even those companies that have established relationships, just because of the process that the banks have to go through in terms of their own internal credit, oftentimes I see them take a couple weeks, maybe even 3 weeks. There probably is, you know, some exceptions to that if they're, you know, somebody that already has a letter of credit facility established. But I would say for the most part, probably 2 to 3 weeks is a safe guideline. Real estate, we generally tell people anywhere from 30 to 60 days. Again, that's going to vary, you know, if there's appraisals, you know, already available, or it can be waived or what have you, but 30 to 60 days is a good range. And then probably 30 days on the marketable securities option.
Some of those are some pretty long horizons. We talked about the short, I guess the federal deadline now lines up more with the state enforceability deadline. But if you're talking a period that's not short enough to prevent the judgment from ever becoming enforceable, that's going to be a strong influencer, I think, in the type of security that the judgment debtor is going to want to post.
Right. Yeah. And sometimes, you know, part of what can be important there is sometimes people only have one form of collateral. You know, they might only have real estate. And so they only have one option. And if that's the case, then they're kind of stuck with whatever time frame that's going to take. And obviously, we always try to do whatever we can to expedite. But that's, you know, another one of those things that people getting kind of educated early. And by our big goal by doing things like this or presentations around the country has always been to educate attorneys so that you all can educate your clients in the event of these circumstances. Mm-hmm. And really, probably the biggest thing you need to know after hearing this is just go start early. And educate yourself on the process. And then once you know that, you can match the two things up. And so if people leave this podcast with anything, I would say, hopefully it's that, because then they can at least get a jump on the process, know what the requirements are, even if they have to revisit it, you know, at the time of a case, because, you know, as you pointed out when we were talking earlier, it might be a few years from now by the time, you know, the people listening on this podcast might encounter this situation. So people don't need to remember all the details as much as there are certain time frames and be cognizant of those when these things come up.
There are certain presentations and podcasts that are sort of evergreen content. And I think going to be one, and I have a few more questions that I want to ask you, and I'm not sure what Jody's got left for you, Dan, but
sure,
this is going to be one that I think is going to be beneficial to refer back to.
Absolutely.
And because I learned more today about the types of security that you all look at than I ever knew before. And, you know, I've been helping a client get a bond. And it sounds like that bond agencies, you know, supersedious companies are kind of like appellate lawyers. You know, you want to have one in your Rolodex that you can call whenever the need arises, even though the need doesn't necessarily arise frequently. And we always, Jody and I talk all the time about how, you know, our job is to educate trial lawyers about, and we like to talk with other appellate lawyers and judges, obviously, on our show, and we want to educate trial lawyers about the best way of going about things. I think, you know, that this is part of that educational process, and that role that we play is, you know, being a resource. And so I think it's extremely valuable to have this information available to the folks who are going to listen to this show. And the idea of early preparation is a theme that we echo a lot on this show. And so it really does pay to be prepared. And even it means, you know, being prepared for a potentially bad outcome. Mm-hmm. I don't think that if someone's going to take a case to trial, you know, you're putting your case in the hands of a jury. you don't really know which way it's going to go. And so it would be smart for a litigant who is being exposed to potentially large judgment to have done some homework on this even before the case goes to trial.
Yeah, I completely agree. It's one of those rare circumstances in life where the stakes are really high, and to do the research, it doesn't cost anything. So the preparation is not, you know, huge hurdle to get over. And the benefits of taking those proactive steps can be monumental. And something else you touched on, we are very similar to the legal industry in that there are generalists and specialists. And that's the only other thing I probably would comment to people is make sure to go to a specialist, just like you want to go to a, you know, an appellate specialist. You want to go to a specialist in these type of bonds, because that's, unfortunately, that's been, you touched on not having heard a lot of this information before. It's one of the downsides of our industry that it's so small to begin with that you take, carve out this little piece of it, and it has been kind of ripe with misinformation, and not intentionally. It's just you have people that are more generalists in our space that don't do this all the time. And so they then communicate what they know to the appellate community, and that becomes kind of the basis for what everybody understands of how this process works. And it's unfortunate because it probably means there's a lot of clients out there that hopefully don't forego the appeal, but maybe don't go through the process in a manner that they could have otherwise.
How important, maybe this is something that you all do in selecting the agencies that you all work with, but how important is something like an AM Best rating in selecting a surety?
Our company will only work with insurance companies that have AM Best ratings with an A or higher. That's probably one area that I would say with regards to the AM Best rating that's of critical importance, because having a B rating can mean that the insurance company is under financial stress and there is a higher likelihood that maybe they won't be around. And if they're not around, then that can obviously cause significant issues. As far as the degree of the A rating, because they further classify those AM Best ratings on financial strength, most of the companies we use are kind of in the upper echelon of those ratings. So it has not become really much of a relevant, you know, factor in how often we have to consider it. There's occasionally that somewhere it might be on the smaller end, but it generally speaking, is as long as they have that A rating, is not really been an issue from our standpoint. One, I'd say probably a bigger consideration, just a follow-up dot on that, is the federal court requiring the sureties to be listed on the Department of Treasury listing. That's an important factor, because otherwise the bond, regardless of the AM Best rating, if they're not listed on that Department of Treasury, they're going to get rejected. So we only will work with surety companies that are on that Department of Treasury listing.
That's really smart. And I guess what you could take away from this, if you're listening, is if you talk to a surety, a supersedious broker like CSBA, you know, going back to that specialization or expertise, you know they're going to know all this stuff. Like Dan's able to rattle off what's required in federal court, you know, off the top of his head. And even those of us as lawyers who do this not infrequently sometimes forget about these things. And so I totally support the notion of, if you're going to be in a situation where you're having to bond a judgment, it probably makes sense. Just like if you're in a case that's important enough to go up on appeal, it makes sense to have an appellate specialist work with you. Same thing with the bonding company. And so I think that's great. And you guys do a great job of filling that niche for sure and making it easy. Do you have a specialized application process? Or how does that work if, like, someone wants to reach out to CSBA and say, hey, I've got a judgment against my client, I want to put them in touch with you? What's the best way, or how do you go about initiating that process?
So it varies really based on preference. You know, I would say probably half the time we're dealing with either trial or appellate counsel directly and may not even be interfacing with the client. And then there's probably the other half where we're dealing with the client either directly or, you know, a combination of the attorney and the client. And so what we typically recommend that people do is just, when there's a need, give us a call, even if the judgment amount is not entered, like I talked about earlier, and it's not known 100%, if we're working with kind of a range, we can then at least start the discussions. And that's kind of where it really has to begin, is going through that process that I mentioned about evaluating time frame, assets that are available, and whether collateral is going to be required. And then kind of once all of that's determined, then we can specifically lay out, you know, next steps. In terms of the paperwork that's required, we don't have an application that we need. It's fairly simple. We just simply get a copy of the court complaint, the judgment once it has been entered, and then the notice of appeal. And those are really the main documents that we get. The only additional thing we might get is financial information if it is one we're trying to evaluate without collateral.
So once you've gone through the process, the bond is in place, the appeal happens, doesn't happen, but whatever, it's over with. Walk us through how the process goes if the judgment creditor makes a claim on the bond. I mean, procedurally, what happens at that point?
So going back to Todd's question about, you know, the sureties that we choose to work with, I would say more often than not, our decision to work with sureties is because most of them have a fairly, you know, strong rating, like I mentioned, and are on that Department of Treasury list. Probably our bigger consideration is working with surety companies that actually have good legal departments and underwriting departments and can handle or know what to do when these claims are made or when we're trying to close out a bond, because that's probably the other area that we hear the most frustration with when it comes, you know, from attorneys, is there's just these incredible inconsistencies with what people are told is needed in order to kind of close out a bond. So, you know, as it relates to claims process, the typical steps are that the attorneys will reach out to file a claim with the surety company directly. Sometimes we'll end up getting, you know, looped into that since we're the ones that actually issued the bond. But in that case, we end up putting them in contact with the surety company's claims department and their legal department. And then what they will do is reach out to the client to determine how they want to proceed with satisfying the judgment. If the surety company has cash or letter of credit, client can instruct them to use the cash or draw on the letter of credit. But the client may also have resources outside of that collateral and want to satisfy it themselves, and in which case, you know, they will satisfy it and then come back to the surety, you know, with that satisfaction of judgment, and the surety company then will release the collateral back to the client. So it really is, I would say, mostly just a communication process to understand, you know, what the client wants. Again, that's part of the reason we like to work with certain surety companies that have those professional claims departments, because they kind of have that process dialed in and know to do that. And then from there, once that communication, everybody's kind of on the same page, then they simply proceed with the steps. In the cases of real estate, you know, where maybe the client doesn't have the assets, the sureties will work with them to see if they can perhaps refinance the property. You know, if they can't, they might have to foreclose on the property. So there are those situations, but it's usually more of a dialogue. You know, the surety doesn't write a check and then start foreclosing on the property. There's going to be a lot more discussion, because it's in the surety's interest to try to work with the client to get it resolved as quickly as possible. And the client wants to probably keep their property. And so figuring out a mutually, you know, beneficial way to kind of go about that is usually what takes place.
Well, we're at the end of the time that we had scheduled for today. Dan, we really appreciate you being with us, and very educational. One thing we like to do with our guests is offer the opportunity to provide a tip or tell a quick war story as we wind up the episode. Did you have something specific that you'd like to share with our listeners?
Yeah, it kind of ties into the timing element that we've touched on so much, which is years ago, we had somebody come to us that wanted to get a supersedes bond. They wanted to use real estate. There's already kind of a time frame involved with real estate. We advised them on those time frames, and there just became a lot of back and forth where there was just a lot of pause. You know, we'd kind of go one step and then there'd be a pause and then another step and a pause, and it just never really came to fruition. And then the long story short is, unfortunately, they got put in a position where the other party was able to pursue the assets and ultimately prevent them from using it as collateral. And it was unfortunate because it was a totally avoidable situation. And I would say we don't see that often, but it does happen. And that's really, worst case scenario that we're always trying to avoid. And so it's fortunately, I would say attorneys by and large have done a great job of encouraging their clients to explore these things and explore them early. So like I said, it doesn't happen often, but when it does, it's always kind of painful to watch because you know it was something that didn't have to happen.
Timing is everything.
That's right.
You know, I was thinking back to our very first episode, and I think Jody described a lot of what we do as appellate lawyers as appellate prevention practice. That part of the process is let's avoid losing your collateral retention practice.
That's right.
Right.
Something like that. I mean, it strikes me, you know, when people don't pay attention to things that they really need to. And if you're paying a lawyer to defend you in a lawsuit and you're facing the prospect of a significant judgment, you know, you really ought to be thinking ahead to the next step. And that doesn't, it's not limited to just an appeal, but you know, what happens if you've got to provide security for a judgment? So you've given our listeners a lot of great information today, Dan. Thanks very much for being with us.
Absolutely.
Thank you guys.
And thank you again too for Court Surety Bond Agency's sponsorship of the podcast. It's been great.
Well, we appreciate it.
So we've already thanked Court Surety Bond Agency today. We usually do that at the end of the show. We'll also thank our other sponsor, Thomson Reuters. We appreciate their support as well.
Thanks for listening to this episode. If you're enjoying the podcast, please recommend it to colleagues you think might benefit from listening.
Taking the time to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts would be great too. We appreciate everyone who has rated us so far.
And if you have questions, thoughts, or comments, please shoot us an email at hosts@techsaplawpod.com. Message us on Twitter or Instagram @TechSapLawPod, or reach out through the podcast Facebook page. We'd love to hear from you.
Until next time, we wish you all the best and hope you're staying healthy.
Thanks for listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. To stay in touch with your hosts, suggest topics, or express interest in coming on the show, visit us online at TexAppLawPod.com or on Twitter @TexAppLawPod. The views expressed by the participants on this podcast are their own and not those of their law firms, courts, or employers. Nothing you hear on this show establishes an attorney-client relationship or is legal advice.